I want it. I want it. 98.1 KZE. This is the Up and Running Morning Show. Good morning to you all. The Who, with the legend Keith Moon on the drums. The Who, an iconic rock and roll band that has sold lots of records and has made a lot of records. And, well, my favorite ones come with drummer Keith Moon behind the kit. He was one of the most wildest drummers ever. He had an incredible sense of rhythm, time, meter. He accented a lot of Roger Daltrey's vocals and made The Who really what they are today. Joining us live in the studio is our friend Tony Fletcher. He is the author of the book Moon and the Life and Death of a Rock Legend. Tony Fletcher is with us this morning. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning, Rick. It's lovely to be here in person. And thanks for that great introduction to Keith, because I think you hit on his musicality, and that is so important when we talk about Keith Moon. So, well, I appreciate that.
You know, you could talk about the wild side of him, and of course that's interesting and sensational, but really what it all comes down to and what I love about him is his musicality and his playing. It, like nobody else. And, you know, when you're a drummer and let's say, you know, you're appreciating somebody's work, whether it's Buddy Rich or whoever, you know, when somebody could say, no, I want you to play like Keith Moon here, or I want you to play like Charlie Watts. There's only a few drummers or play a Levon beat here that have a signature drumming style. And Keith Moon was one.
I always think of him as being orchestral. Huh. And on my short drive up, I was listening to one of my favorite drumming tracks by him, which is The Undertura in the Middle of Tommy. Huh. And I just think of him as this sort of symphonic drummer. But you're quite right. He accented Roger Daltrey's words a lot. The Who was a sort of upside down rock band. But I think as much as anything, it's important to say he revolutionized the drummer's role in pop music. There is actually a pre-Keith Moon and a post-Keith Moon. Huh. And when you want to talk about other people, somebody could say, well, surely, you know, John Bonham or Mitch Mitchell. It's like, yeah, but they came afterwards. And even when you talk about Ginger Baker, who I admire greatly and interviewed for this book, he was a jazz drummer before Keith and only joined rock groups after Keith had paved the way.
So before Keith was in The Who, what did he do?
He was in other bands. He was a kid growing up in suburban Wembley post-war. I find the post-war concept, the post-war reality for all of these British rock bands to be so integral. Most of them were born towards the very end of the war, when I think it was known that the Allies were going to win. Keith was born in 1946, so a year after the end of the war. They grew up mainly to families that, if their parents had fought, would not talk about it. The parents wanted a quiet life. There was probably, there's no probably about it, enormous amounts of suppressed PTSD. Hmm. And Keith's parents were especially quiet. They didn't drink. He had two younger sisters. But it's like every now and then, most of us have an inherit at traits from our parents. Every now and then somebody comes along, gets dropped on the planet that you say, well, where did that come from? And Keith is one of those people. He was irrepressible from the beginning. His energy was off the charts. He was a troublemaker. But, I mean, a good-natured and mischievous troublemaker from the youngest age, always getting in trouble. And you gradually worked his way into rock and roll. And I think something that's just integral to all of these groups, around the mid-50s, so when Keith was just about hitting 10 years old, not only did rock and roll come in from the States, but skiffle happened in the UK. Skiffle was just this very basic street version of jazz and then picking up on some rock and roll. And
yeah, it's
with that,
like a fast ska.
Yeah, I mean, there's actually a great book about skiffle that Billy Bragg wrote, and just in the last couple of years, came out about 2 or 3 years ago. Really good book about skiffle and its importance in British music. But all of that just attracted whole generation. Yeah. And it created a generation gap because these kids had money, because there were jobs. And Keith was in it wholesale. And he worked his way through different groups until he could find his way to the one he wanted to join. Huh. And that was the band that became The Who.
So how did he, and I know it's kind of legendary, but how did he get into The Who?
Right. Well, you know, I was just before we came on air, I said I've been rereading this book for the first time in a long time. And it's a big book, and I'm not going to get to read it all by Thursday's event that that we're in here for, Thursday's event at the Orpheum. But I reread the legend of how he got into The Who, and I was like, wow, that's such a great legend. And then I remembered that, but that's... there's a dispute on that, and sure enough, it follows. I'm like, I write in the book, this is the stuff of legend, but it may not be true. The legend is that he went up to The Who, what they were called the Detours at the time, at the Railway Hotel during the interval, and said, I can drum better than your drummer. And they said, well, go and prove it. And he sat in on a couple of songs at the start of the second set and proved it and kind of destroyed the kit. And they said, all right, what are you doing next weekend? It's such a great legend that I realized, hang on, why was nobody there? I'm interviewing all these people for the book. Why is nobody I interviewed saying, oh, yeah, I was there that night? But the person I did interview was the promoter who ran the club. Booked both the Detours and Keith's band, the Beachcombers, that he was in. And said, you know, it was so obvious. And The Who had a drummer who was like 6-7 years older than them, married. He wasn't cutting it. They needed somebody young and energetic. They'd actually parted ways with him, had a temporary drummer, and were looking. And this guy, Bob Drew, said, I basically told Keith, go down to The Who's practice room, tell them I sent you, and they'll probably know who you are, and give it a try. And I said, it's not impossible that he then was told, well, you can try out this week at the show, maybe on a different night than their regular night, and just do a couple of songs, see how you fit in before we make a decision. Yeah.
Wow. You know what this band's missing? Me.
Yeah. Well, there's, you know, the Beachcombers, he was too much for the Beachcombers. They were also older. They were lovely people. I got to interview all of them.
Really?
Well, what style of music was he playing?
Name makes it sound like it was surf music. And the thing is, Keith loved surf music. It's why he ended up in LA, in Malibu. Adored surf music, probably, you know, because the drums were so much to the fore. But I think he was also attracted to a lifestyle, an image of sun, surf, and sand, and beautiful women. You know, he's growing up in a post-war Wembley that had been bombed. One of the primary schools had been bombed to oblivion. And so he had a fantasy of a different environment. But the Beachcombers actually had marketed themselves before Keith joined as Shadows of the Shadows. So they were very much your entertaining rock and roll band, doing what rock and roll bands did prior to the Beatles, turning it upside down and writing their own songs. So they loved Keith to bits, but they sort of knew they couldn't keep him, hold on to him. And I think they were all very, very happy and knew that it made sense for him to join this other band that was wild in every aspect except their drummer.
True. Well, he completed their picture, and The Who are the legend they are. And a lot of it is due to Keith Moon's drumming. Just even their early songs like Happy Jack, I mean, he accented all the vocals on that, and it's... it wouldn't be the same song without Keith.
Yeah, I actually, in the book, I say as early as I can't explain, the first single, when it gets to the chorus, there's this little da-da-da. he emphasizes Roger's words from the beginning. And Roger is actually very aware of that. There's a clip I'm going to show on Thursday where they're all talking about Keith. And Roger is very, very aware of that. And there's also, the band is just sort of upside down. You know, Keith is fulfilling the role of a lead guitarist. Pete is almost like a bass player in that he's holding down the chords.
The whole rhythm.
John is now kind of doing solo playing over the top. It's a very, you know, last I talked to you was about REM, and they're a similarly kind of upside down band, and I think that makes things really, really interesting when your rhythm section is not doing what a rhythm section is typically meant to do.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because there are guitar solos in The Who's music, but for the most part, Keith is the backbone of the whole thing and keeps it all together, where he can let Keith solo and let John Entwistle play his fluid bass lines over stuff. Yeah. And that added to the chemistry of the whole group. And the surprise element of anything could happen, along with, well, they had a desire to bust things.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, The Who are my favorite group. I guess I've talked to you about my two favorite groups. I sort of think REM are a perfect group, even down to breaking up as friends. The Who have meant more to me than any other band in my life from the youngest age, from the age of like 10 or 11.
So what was it that attracted you to the band at 10, 11 years old?
I think it was something that Keith and maybe the others felt, but I'm sure Keith felt. They made me feel that there was a big world out there. I was growing up in suburban South London, and nothing wrong with my life. Parents divorced or getting divorced, which was unusual in the 70s, but nothing wrong with my life. And when I'm thinking particularly of the album Who's Next, but also the singles that followed. Joined Together was the first I heard of them. And it's partly the production, but they just called up a massive world out there. They called up a world of loud, very loud rock music, of, you know, the song Is Over, which is on that album. You know, they're literally singing about the mountains and things. And it's like there is a world out there and there's a freedom. Mm. And I think The Who were all rebelling against that repression that Britain was so repressed.
Well, there's a lot of counterculture in all their songs as well. And they connect right to it. So if you're feeling that way that they're singing about, especially from Britain or anywhere around the world, you still feel the same thing. My generation, doesn't matter what country you live in, you feel the same thing.
You do.
It's pretty amazing how expressive their music actually is. And, well, just like what we said. Yeah, so now come Thursday, Tony, what happens at this event? It's at the Orpheum Theater in Saugerties. You're going to be reading from The Life and Death of a Rock Legend, Moon. You said you're going to show a clip. What happens? This is a multimedia experience.
Yeah. We had a very, I want to thank the Orpheum for actually reaching out to me, Paul, there, maybe as long as a year ago, and saying, I love your books. Can we do something together? Because I like to do events. And we've decided to hone in on anniversaries. So the REM event, which was the first, was the 40th anniversary of their first album, which is a classic, Murmur. This Thursday is a much sadder event. It is the 45th anniversary of Keith Moon's death at the ridiculously premature age of 32. My book came out all the way back in 1998, 20 years after he died.
And
My editor in the UK was Chris Charlesworth, was a former Melody Maker journalist, quite close to The Who at times. And he made sure it tied in right around that anniversary. And so we're kind of, what we're calling it is a celebration of Keith Moon's life. Nice. We're celebrating the life of Keith Moon. So it's not so much reading from the book. I am going to read some excerpts, and I've been highlighting things that I think still stand, you know, the test of time and are relevant. I found with doing the REM event, talking about the process gets really interesting. Talking about what goes into writing a book, researching a book, the people I met, the things that I learned. I honestly think, especially if a book's not new, if I go to a book event, I'm more interested in the person talking about the book. Yeah. I'm usually more interested in the Q&A, and there will be a Q&A, and we'll allow time for that. I'm interested in all of that. So there will be video clips, absolutely. I've been lining all of those up. I mean, there's so much to choose
now,
from.
Now, in the research for the book, did you get to interview Roger, John, or maybe not John, but Pete?
Well, funnily enough, John was the one I did interview. So I got to interview almost everybody that mattered. And that was meant to include Pete. And It got as far as I literally woke up on the morning. I was meant to be flying to, it may have been Ohio, to interview Pete.
Oh, wow.
And I had a fax waiting for me. Remember faxes?
Yeah.
I had a fax waiting for me from his wonderful, lifelong, long-suffering assistant back in London saying, Pete's called it off. And he, I recognize now he'd taken the WHO back on the road for the first time in a long time. And he was struggling with his memories of Keith Moon. He was struggling with the damage that he thought Keith had done to his own life. And he literally wrote to me and said, it was along the lines of, I can't think of anything to say about Keith that would not be unkind. I can't do this.
Wow.
So that was tough. And after the book came out, he sent down word that he kind of wished he'd done it. But that's okay. There were so many quotes from Pete. And he changes his mind a lot anyway. So there's a contrasting quotes on almost anything.
Really?
I had a sense Roger wasn't going to participate, though funnily enough, the book is now optioned for the movie that Roger's meant to be making. And I did spend time with John. I want to point out that I spent time with about 100 other people. They included his ex-wife, Kim, which was really, it was about the last interview I got. She had never talked to anybody. When
Wow.
he died, the tabloids threw offers of money at her. She turned everything down. She was married to Ian McLagan. They were living in Austin.
Wow.
And I went down and I arranged to spend one night. And they actually, we talked so much. She said, why don't you stay with us for a second night? Can you change your flight?
Wow.
So I came home with God knows how many hours of tape from her.
Oh, wow.
I also got to interview his girlfriend that he was with him when he died.
Wow.
And that involved two trips to Sweden. And there's everybody from people who, lots of people who are no longer with us, but managers, Chris Stamp, Bill Kerbishley, a host of musicians, and the likes of Oliver Reed, Larry Hagman, and Margaret, Alice Cooper, Jeff Beck, Dave Edmonds.
Wait a second. What did JR have to do?
I know. I love that people say this.
Larry Hagman, I Dream of Jeannie. What did he have to do with Keith
Moon?
Yeah,
this comes up quite often. And actually, you've caught me a little bit because it's going to be either That'll Be the Day or more likely the movie Stardust that Larry Hagman is in. Keith was in a couple of fantastic rock and roll movies, and Larry Hagman was in one of them. And Keith just always bonded with wild people, and Larry had that streak, and they became really, really good friends.
How cool.
It was even cooler when I was told Larry will give you a call, and he called on my oldest son's, I think it was his first birthday party, and my wife took great delight in coming into the garden and saying, Tony, Larry Hagman's on the phone for you. That doesn't happen too many times, I have to say. That's why I'm making a big deal of it. It was kind of funny. All these other parents were like, hang on, what did she just say?
Did you believe him when he talked to you? This isn't one of my friends putting me on.
Well,
right
here's a fascinating thing, Rick, that I have found out. The bigger the star, the more they are comfortably in control of their own lives. And I had two or three occasions where I was told, either here's somebody's number, they're expecting your call, or they'll give you a call, and they will because they like to do it themselves.
Huh.
And Oliver Reed was another. And more recently, I wrote a book with Eddie Floyd, and he had a relationship. Well, Bruce Springsteen's covered a lot of his songs. And I thought, let me see if I can get to talk to Bruce. And his office instantly said he'll do this. And eventually it was like, expect a call from Bruce Springsteen. And sure enough, there's nobody else set up the call. Actually, initially he forgot, but then he did call me. I mean, and actually it wasn't even with a blocked number. These people will Wow. do that. They get to a point of comfort where, and it must have been a Sunday that Larry Hagman called me. I'm sure it
Wow.
was. And they get to a degree of comfort.
So you get on your caller ID, Springsteen B.
Maybe it's a burner. He might have to throw them out every couple of weeks. Who knows?
Tony Fletcher, live 98.1 KZE. Tony is the host of The Celebration and Life of Keith Moon, Orpheum Theater, 7 o'clock, September 7th. unfortunately, the anniversary of Keith Moon's 45th.
I also want to say we do have a bit of a drum clinic going on. That's the multimedia aspect, really. For REM, we put together a one-off tribute group. Jason Bowman, not Bonham, Jason Bowman, who is the director at the Rock Academy here where I direct shows, where I work, and have had a wonderful time working with kids the last few years. Sweet. He is going to come in with a drum kit and essentially break down some of Keith's most famous drum parts. And hopefully, I mean, this is all somewhat on the fly, be able to show people what it is that Keith's doing. And that brings us back around to that musicality. That we came in on, the fact that Keith was not just a wild man lashing out at drums. He knows what he's doing, hears what he's doing, and I'm really, really looking forward to that because Jason's an amazing drummer and an amazing drum teacher as well.
And Jason also loves to kick over his drums.
We'll see if he does it.
Jason's an awesome drummer and a great cat. Tony, thank you so much for joining us this morning. It's a pleasure. I could talk to you all day long, and that wouldn't be fair to the people who love music. So we got to get back to music. But folks, get tickets. Be in attendance at the Orpheum Theater this Thursday, 7 o'clock. It's going to end early, start early, have a little supper around town, maybe go to the Orpheum, check out the event. And then you'll be home before you know it, and you can wake up and go to work the next day or do whatever you have to do. But it's inexpensive on your wallet. It's going to be an informative, amazing night. And if you love The Who and rock and roll, you're going to love this amazing event. Tony, thank you for being here.
Thanks so much, Rick.
It's a pleasure. Again, Thursday at 7, Orpheum Theater in Saugerties. Tony, how can folks stay, you know, adrift of what you got coming out, what you have coming up?
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for asking. I've joined other writers, other creatives who are using Substack as a great place to be able to just host your writing, and people get it in their inbox. They can get just updates, newsletters. I put out two things a week. It's free.
Wow, cool.
It's free. There is a paid option where I'm going to be doing interview archives from the Keith Moon book, but the initial, you know, you can subscribe for free. It's Tony Fletcher. .substack.com. It's that easy. Just sign up. Yep. Enter your own email address. It's free. And if you want to kind of sign up for more later down the line, feel free to do so. Thanks.
It's the Up and Running Morning Show on 98.1 KZE, 9:32. We'll be right back.
The science behind the smile. That's the focus at the Uptown Kingston Dental Office.